Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscowane. For those who have struggled recently to find a job, the news from the Labor Department earlier this month might seem to be reason for celebration. After 91 months of job growth, the unemployment rate has dipped to 3.9%. A rate not seen in nearly two decades. So this hour, we ask, where are the jobs? How does the picture look for this spring's college grads? How about those who are middle-aged or older who might be interested in getting back into the work world or switching employers? It can be a challenging job. Job hunting online often means bots are the first entities, if you will, to see a resume. And they can be quick to weed out applications way before a job seeker's information reaches the human resources person. Also, is branding still relevant? There's lots to talk about. And joining us today on Radio Times to help us navigate is Paul Harrington, Director for the Center of Labor Markets and Policy at Drexel University. Paul joins us in studio. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Mary.
And Alana Gershon is author of Down and Out in the New Economy, How People Find or Don't Find Work Today. Hello, Alana.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to Radio Times. And as always, here's the number to call to join the conversation. It's 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Paul, to you first. What do you make of the unemployment rates dip below 4%?
Well, more importantly even is that for the first time, the ratio of unemployed workers to vacant jobs is equal. And that's sort of the economist's bedrock definition of full employment, right? So there's about 6.2 million unemployed workers, about 6.2 million vacant jobs. So there's lots of job opportunities, fair number of job seekers, but a lot of mismatch going on in the labor market still. Hmm. It's going to be hard to get the unemployment rate below this full employment level. But when you look at the recovery, it's very broad-based. Men got really beat up in the recession last time. White men, black men, Hispanic men have all regained all the losses that they've had. Women did not get roughed up, but it's also true for white men, black women, white women, black women, and Hispanic women. The gains that they did sustain, the losses they sustained, they did recover. Mm-hmm. Older workers are actually doing better than they had prior to the recession in terms of their share of jobs. The only group that's still really roughed up are teens and young adults. They're still having difficulty a lot.
And yeah. We will get to those that particular group in just a bit on Radio Times. But Alana, I just wanted to get your perspective here.
I am delighted to know that the statistics are doing so much better, but the fact of the matter is the people who I was studying and doing ethnographic research with are still having problems with the mismatch. This is still a huge problem because the ways in which we look for people to employ and the ways in which people who are trying to find jobs are dealing with technologies and ideologies that aren't for their benefit.
So we're talking about the jobs that are out there? I'm sorry, we're talking about the jobs that are out there versus the skill set that is needed for those jobs?
Yes.
Is it a
What I'm saying is that it's hard to figure out whether someone has the skill set that you need or not, given that you're screening them through LinkedIn profiles and resumes and very canned job interview and questions.
Yeah. Well, and that's what we'd like to get into, the process of actually finding a job. The news looks very rosy on the, just at first glance. But when it gets down to the nitty gritty of the job hunt, it can be a lot more challenging than just having a low, a low unemployment rate. Let's first, before we go there, let's talk about wages, because they are not increasing at a corresponding pace, are they, Alana?
No, they're not. And there are a lot of legal mechanisms put in place so that there isn't a pressure on the employer to have to increase the wages.
How do health care costs fit into that picture, if at all? The fact that wages aren't increasing, is that are employers stressed to kind of keep that particular piece of the picture stable as they struggle with high healthcare costs?
this really isn't my expertise.
I apologize. I apologize because I know that your expertise, we're going to talk about the job hunt and resumes and et cetera in just a moment. So let me just throw that one to Paul and we'll wrap up that line.
Paul, you can handle it.
So a couple of things. Okay. You know, on the wage question, you know, mean wage, you know, the measures we have of wages are sort of the average, right? But at the margin, what we find is that at the entry level, we're actually finding new hires, wage rates are rising. About half the firms now in a recent Federal Reserve survey say the way they're adjusting to these labor supply problems is they're raising wages. So we're starting to see some at the entry level. And what that if that is sustained, then you'll start seeing this wage compression where someone, say, 2 or 3 years are saying, hey, you know, you're paying this new guy almost the same as you're paying me. I want a pay raise. That's when that overall wage structure will start rising. But that at the entry level, we're seeing it, but at the average, we're not yet. But if this recession, if the expansion continues, we'll do okay. With respect to the healthcare issue, it's a very complicated issue. I've been involved in evaluating the effects of cost containment in the healthcare system in Massachusetts for the last 5 years for the Office of State Auditor there. And one of the things we have seen is a tremendous adjustment in the composition of healthcare employment, that the way we keep costs down is we don't allow hospital and nursing home employment to grow. We grow and where we're growing is in home health aid and personal care attendant occupations with a aging at home and chronic illness at home strategy. So that's the mechanism that's really in place now to keep health costs down.
Okay. All right, Alana, so over to you. And I apologize for stepping on you a little bit there earlier in the show. Let's actually get to the process of searching for employment. One hallmark of today's search is the emphasis on developing your own brand. And just in thinking about this, it seems to be an intimidating process. And you have to ask, is it something that's absolutely necessary?
So I was really interested in the fact that when I talked to hiring managers and people in HR and recruiters about what they looked for, no one actually mentioned looking at someone's brand. And no one told me, oh, I had to bring them in for an interview. They had such a great brand. But when I talk to job seekers about this, they say, well, it's not that you're supposed to notice the brand. It's supposed to be the techniques by which you brand yourself that are unconsciously being noticed. And I have to say, people never seem to pay any attention to the techniques either. And so by the end of interviewing 150 people about the job process, I began to think maybe branding is not what you put your time into.
So what there should be some sort of presentation, of course. How do you shape that for the person who is, say, entering the job market and hasn't been out in the hunt for a while?
Well, part of what you need to do is do a lot of research on the kinds of workplaces that you're trying to enter into. And people are often kind and willing to talk to you for half an hour to an hour about what their workplace is like and what their own work history experience has been like. And I think doing that kind of research to find out what's going on is more helpful for understanding how you should be shaping the presentation of yourself. I mean, like, it's not like you don't need a competent LinkedIn profile and a competent resume, but every workplace interprets these genres, these forms differently, and you need to find out how different workplaces and different professions are interpreting these forms.
So if, say, you wanted to get a job in the publishing industry, you're saying perhaps we should find somebody who's already working in the industry and learn a little bit about it before you present yourself as a job applicant.
And learn a little bit about what they think about the different presses or the different media companies that you might be entering into. Because each company develops its own way of interpreting what is a good candidate.
Let's talk about, you touched on sites like LinkedIn a little bit. Paul, what do you think of the value is of sites like LinkedIn? Is it essential to be involved with that sort of genre if you're looking for work today?
Well, so a lot of the hires that are actually made on LinkedIn are already employed persons who aren't looking for a job. And headhunters are looking for people with specific kinds of characteristics around literacy and numeracy skills, maybe a particular technical skill. Certain kinds of work experiences. And so they use LinkedIn and similar sorts of networks to find those individual proficiencies, whether they're job seekers or not. So it's a really great hunting ground for headhunters. And the vast majority of hires off LinkedIn are actually already employed people who are not engaged in a job search. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure it's necessarily a great way for a person at the entry level, kid coming out of college, for example, to get in there. Yeah.
But is it still important to develop a LinkedIn profile?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's useful to have a LinkedIn profile to let people know these are my proficiencies, whether you're a consultant or a job seeker or just an incumbent worker, because it's a way of advertising yourself without any heavy lifting.
All right. Hey, Ilana, you say increasingly people have begun to see themselves as individual businesses. What does that mean exactly?
Well, what I think has happened, what underlies the branding question that you asked me earlier, is that the metaphor by which people understand themselves as workers has changed. And so people used to understand themselves as though they were property and they rented themselves to the employer for a specific period of time. And now that metaphor, since the 1980s, has shifted, and people think of themselves as though they are a business, a bundle of skills, assets, relationships, experiences, and qualities that has to be managed as though it was a business and has to be constantly enhanced. And so when you're entering into an employment contract, it's now being understood as a business-to-business contract. And so it becomes very easy for people to think, oh, if I have to imagine myself as a business, then I should market myself as though I was a business, and so I need a brand. And I think the idea of branding came out not because it was something that was necessary in order to get a job, but because this metaphor drives it.
Hmm. So is that something that if you're out there and you're hunting for a job, you can do without? Do we need to view ourselves as individual businesses and then do the brand, or can you kind of get around that?
Well, I have a lot of hope that you can get around that.
Hmm. What are the benefits of getting around it?
Well, the benefits of getting around it are that you begin to think about other workers not as your business competitors, but as people who you need to be in alliance with and working together with, that it's a strong, rejecting the metaphor gives you a strong impulse towards thinking of yourself as part of a community in which you are doing good deeds for the community, and the community will do good deeds for you as well. So it makes you think about what it means to be unemployed as being part of a community, kind of being able to go in and out of a community of people who are your workers. Your fellow workers.
And so getting around, you know, you don't necessarily have to consider yourself as an individual business. You don't necessarily have to put together a brand. You just put together a good resume and get out there and start trying to find the job. Is it as simple as that?
Well, I think you have to be clever about the research that you do. You have to be sure that the ways in which you're talking about your skills matches the ways in which people who are looking for you expect you to be talking about your skills. And you also have to work on when I was talking about the community, I really meant it seriously. You have to know people in the business that you are entering into and develop good relationships with them.
Okay.
Which some people are anxiously calling networking. I'm trying to avoid that word.
I am. Oh, all right. We'll try to, we'll get into that a little bit too as we move on with this show on jobs on Radio Times. Up against a break, Ilana Gershon is author of Down and Out in the New Economy. Paul Harrington is in studio with us. He's professor in the School of Education at Drexel University. And we'll be right back here on Radio Times. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are focusing on unemployment. It is the lowest it's been in almost two decades at 3.9%. So this hour, we're talking about the changing landscape of the job hunt, interviewing, resumes, personal branding. Ilana Gershon is author of Down and Out in the New Economy, How People Find or Don't Find Work Today. She is a professor of anthropology at Indiana University, Bloomington. Paul Harrington, professor in the School of Education at Drexel and is also director for the Center of Labor Markets and Policy at Drexel University. The number to call is 888-477-9499 if you have questions or comments. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Paul, where are the jobs and in which industry?
So for kids coming out of college, a lot of opportunity in something called the professional, scientific, and technical industry. What's in there? It's big accounting, consulting firms, engineering firms, about one in five computer science majors get jobs in that field. So it's a very concentrated, very rapidly growing field. A lot of it in Philadelphia, actually. Mm-hmm. The other segments of the college labor market for kids coming out of college, finance is still doing pretty well. Parts of the health service industry still strong. Government has kind of bounced back a little bit. For non-college grads, construction has come back very strongly. We're back to our pre-recession employment levels, which are actually quite strong at that time. Manufacturing is doing better than expected. Still not a boomer, but better than we had been. And, there's some manufacturing firms that are having trouble getting workers, I can tell you that. Skilled blue-collar workers. Lots and lots of job growth in leisure and hospitality, eating and drinking establishments, hotels and restaurants. Tremendous amount of growth. So when you look at this thing, you say, what kind of jobs are getting? Pretty strong growth in the college labor market. Very rapid growth in kind of low-level service positions. Yeah. And then some of the blue-collar jobs have come back as well. So it's pretty broad-based expansion, pretty good opportunities for lots of different kinds of job seekers.
Okay, so let's focus on recent college grads for just a moment and bring Laura Craig into the conversation. Laura is Associate Director of Career Development at Temple University, the Career Center there. Laura, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary.
So in your perspective, Laura, the young people who are graduating, say, this month, which grads will likely have the most luck in the hunt? Those who focused on the STEM courses?
So our data does show from recent graduates that the people that become employed right away do tend to be in some of those STEM fields. We do survey at graduation 6 months after graduation, but I wouldn't say that that's an exclusionary point, that if you're not in a STEM field that you couldn't find a job at graduation. I think in the bigger picture, it's the graduate who's prepared, like Alana mentioned, the graduate who's done the research, who has started working on establishing relationships in the areas that they're interested in. They're definitely more likely to be successful.
There's a school of thought that those in the humanities might have a tougher time of it. What do you think?
I've been very exposed to that school of thought. I've worked at two different liberal arts institutions before coming to Temple. And I think some of the challenges for students in the humanities is that they aren't sure how to get exposure to knowing what's out there. They know that there are a lot of jobs out there, but it feels very overwhelming, so it's hard to know where to start. And that's often a lot of conversations that we have with students. They literally come in and they say, I have no idea what's going on, and I really need help figuring out where to start in order to get an internship. My parents are telling me to get an internship, or, I keep hearing about these great jobs that my friends in the business school are getting, and I want to get in on that action.
So what do you tell them?
I definitely start with just getting to know where they've been at and where their thoughts are, because oftentimes students don't realize that they know more about what they want than they think they know. So we start there, and then I start to check in on kind of where are they at in constructing some of those documents. LinkedIn profiles were mentioned earlier, resumes were mentioned earlier. We do a lot of work with students on either constructing those from the very beginning or improving an existing document. And as that process goes on, students really start to learn a little bit more about themselves, and then we start talking about, okay, what's next now that you've thought about how you're communicating your skills? Do we want to apply to jobs? Are there events happening on campus that would be to your benefit to go to? Could we be using LinkedIn to help you establish more relationships and get in contact with more people in your field?
Alana Gerson, anything you want to add to this?
I think this sounds like really good advice. I think one of the things that people often don't know when they're in humanities fields is that all the research that they've been trained to do in writing research papers and in uncovering information is actually the kind of information that they need to be able to do in figuring out what job they want as well. That a lot of the writing skills and a lot of the research skills are things that they can apply to the job market, and they often don't connect the dots in this way. And so a career services that encourages them to do that is really great.
Go ahead, Laura.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, Alana. In my first job in the field, I actually worked at a very small liberal arts college that had a rhetoric program where students were required to pass a certain level of proficiency in order to graduate. When I would visit some students in internships, uniformly, every single employer talked about their writing, their research, and their communication skills far surpassing what their other student interns were able to do.
Paul Harrington, when it comes to minority grads, things have apparently shifted for the worse. According to a report from the Economic Policy Institute, whites and blacks who graduated in 2000 earned the same wage. But in 2018, African-American grads earned 17% less than white grads. And this is despite what seems to be a real effort to cultivate diversity in many workplaces. Any thoughts as to why the disparity?
When I've kind of examined the college labor market in great detail, and I've used this database called PACT, Program for an International Assessment of Adult Skills, and you know, tried to develop a set of statistical models that predict these job market outcomes. You know, but what you find is once you account for a major field of study and some other factors, these disparities go away. So the question, you know, that I would have for EPI, because I haven't seen their study, is do we see a shift in the major field of study of these youngsters? Mm-hmm. And I don't know the answer to that. But major oftentimes has an important influence on your employment and earnings experiences, particularly immediately after, you know, graduating from college. So that would be my first thought about that. Second thing is that over the years, the job content of the economy has really changed radically. And, you know, some of the work experiences, you know, in the higher education system, we've sort of downplayed this role of work experience. You just think, come to Paul Harrington. Professor Harrington will tell you all you need to know. And it turns out that's a really bad idea. And so for a lot of young people, getting, you know, kind of having a curricular and extracurricular experience that's connected to an objective is really important. And I think trying to get that organized is, you know, really an important strategy and the question is are there racial and gender differences and those kinds of things as well? I don't know the answer to that, but those are the things I would look at to try and understand that.
According to recent published reports, the unemployment rate for college grads overall is just under 5.5%, which is probably not too bad, but the underemployment rate is just over 10%. Underemployment, Laura Craig, means what? And does the low jobless rate right now offer some hope in this, to alleviate this?
So I think you and I may have seen the same report recently. I definitely noted something that landed in my inbox about that very topic with interest. And underemployment can be a complicated issue. I think it's most frequently defined as you're working in a job that doesn't require the level of educational credentials that you have. And in the particular report that I had seen recently, it noted that this is particularly a problem for women. And it really made me think about the sense of, yes, this can be a problem, an issue, but there's certainly a lot more that goes into it that is kind of beyond the scope of where we in career services can influence. There may be some things going on in the student's life or in their family or community as well. So it's definitely an issue, and it's something that we're concerned about. We do, in the case of here at Temple, we work with students after graduation on an unlimited basis in that first year to be available to them, make resources available to them. They can still continue to come to our recruitment events on campus. So we do what we can with the scale that we have in order to help connect all Temple students and alumni.
And one more quick question for you, Laura. Worth noting, in a study profiled by Inside Higher Ed, you mentioned women and underemployment. So women who are recent college grads are nearly half, 47% underemployed compared to 37% of men. And this is before, you know, a lot of women perhaps go a little slower in the workplace because of family obligations. How do we explain this? Any thoughts?
It's definitely a challenging issue. I think I connect with this issue when I'm delivering some workshops on salary negotiation here on campus. A lot of those issues come up of negotiating for salary and managing the different flows of life, whether you're ready to start a family or you already have a family or you need to balance work against caregiving. So it's an issue that students are aware aware of. It's an issue that we're trying to support. And we support it in a couple of different ways in our office. Our career coaches and our outreach specialists who work together to connect students to opportunities are regularly bringing in alumni and employers that speak to the specific communities that we have here at Temple, diverse student communities, veterans, many others, to try and address and help them get those relationships to overcome underemployment.
Ilana Gershon, let's take a quick look at resumes. If you are underemployed, how do you put your best foot forward when putting together a resume?
Well, what you want to do is understand what the jobs are that you're aiming for, what kinds of resumes seem to be successful in those contexts, right? So oftentimes it's really, you're asking about the resume. Oftentimes it's really not the resume. Like, if the resume can get you to an interview level, then your resume is fine. Part of the problem of worrying about resumes is that everybody has different pieces of advice for how to format the resume and how to make it look as good as possible. And if your resume is getting into the interview stage, it's good enough.
So we still need a resume, correct? If you're going to apply, and most applications, my understanding is you're doing it online these days.
Yes.
What do you need to put into that bare bones to hopefully get a potential employer's attention?
That's funny. I've never been asked this because everybody seems to just automatically assume they know what is supposed to be in a resume, right? Like, you have the list of what you have done previously. People, because you're now supposed to be told you have to imagine yourself as a business, you're supposed to transform every job that you have had into a series of bullet points of what you have accomplished at those jobs. Though I have to say, this is really for white-collar work that I'm talking about. And you have to be able to explain in the resume why what you're doing seems to apply to that particular job. And so part of what's happened now that people have LinkedIn profiles is that they think of LinkedIn profiles as the general document explaining your most general employment history, and the resume mm-hmm. is the specific document that is supposed to be tailored to that company. And so when you're putting together the resume, you think, well, someone who's putting together the applicant tracking system and programming it is going to be kicking out my resume, is going to be programming it based on the job description that they have. So you want to make sure that your resume reflects the words of the job description in some way.
Sure. The temptation to pad, perhaps stretch the accomplishments, I'm assuming that's a no-no.
I think that if you're going to be caught at this, then that is a definite no-no. And there are many ways to catch people nowadays.
All right. Let's get to the phones. MJ in Atco, New Jersey, you are live on Radio Times. Hello.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is specifically about older workers. My husband and I are in our 50s, or early 50s, and my husband has a lot of experience as a teacher, like 15 years plus, but he's had a horrible time finding a job, and I've had a hard time finding a job, as are my other friends who are our age who are trying to find work. Where do we look, and how do we even get people to call us back? They see our resumes and our experience, and are like, oh, forget it, you're overqualified. We don't want to pay you. Mm-hmm. You know, so we can get two people to do your job for, you know, what we would have to pay you. So what are our strategies for finding work?
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, MJ. Paul Harrington, I'm sure that this is just, so common in this day and age. You hit a certain age, and then all of a sudden the opportunities seem to dry up, or do they?
Well, so all the workers have actually, the employment rate, in other words, a fraction of older workers, the older persons that have a job, has actually really shot up a lot, even among people 75 and above. In fact, I just was going through some stuff last night. I expect by next 10 years, number of people 75 and older, working would rise to 13% in the United States.
Well, what sort of jobs were we talking about?
Well, so what's happened is two things go on here. One is number of older workers to stay in their job for extended periods of time after kind of the traditional retirement age, because the physical requirements of the job are quite low. So you're able to do this for longer periods of time. And there's more uncertainty about pension values and things like this, right? Second thing, though, is that a lot of retirees we see coming back into the job market, when they do that, they actually go into traditional teen entry-level jobs. They go into eating and drinking establishments, hotels, motels, retail. So when you go to the Acme grocery store now, you see an old guy like me bagging, doing the grocery bagging, right? I mean, so it's a very different kind of job market for older workers. For someone who's in their 50s who, is a retired teacher and says, I'd like to replace my wage, that's going to be a tall order. The research sort of says when older workers get dislocated, they're probably going to come back with about somewhere between a 15% and 20% wage reduction as a consequence of that.
And that's something you have to accept. I mean, the dreaded word is overqualified, and if an employer thinks that, they're probably going to be thinking, well, I also have to pay this person.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that older workers have going for them now is this is a full employment economy. And employers on a couple of scores prefer older workers, and they prefer them around behavioral characteristics and social skills. And when you look at a lot of the jobs that are out there, the social skills, what are they? The communication, negotiation kind of skills, and a wide range of jobs. That's what service is, right? A service economy, that's what that is. And then the fundamental character traits, showing up on time, reliability, dependability, self-control. So, we've actually seen employers' preferences shift away from, especially teens and young adults 20 to 24, towards people over the age of 55 and above. Problem is, a lot of these are jobs that are, not very high-skilled jobs and so don't pay high wages.
Yeah. And one more very quick question for Laura before we let you go. Laura, we've got about 15 seconds. Paul had mentioned that the older workers are sometimes going for jobs at entry-level for young people. How do they compete? Or are we talking about two completely different groups?
We may be talking about two completely different groups, but I think young people can still compete, especially if they know how to frame their skills and they get a little bit of support in that process in doing so. So,
right. Laura, unfortunately, I've got to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times. Laura Craig is Director of Career Development at Temple University Career Center. We continue our conversation on jobs in just a moment. Keep it here. You're listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. We're talking about the super low unemployment rate, 3.9%. The lowest it's been in almost two decades. So what jobs are out there? How to go for them? In studio with us, Paul Harrington, Director for the Center of Labor Markets and Policy at Drexel University. Alana Gershon is author of Down and Out in the New Economy, How People Find or Don't Find Work Today. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number's 888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. We've got an email from Allison who says, I'm in my early 50s consulting and have been looking for a full-time job for more than 2 years. My experience now versus 10 or 15 years ago is that almost all employers all do phone screening first. I've been frustrated with the quality of these screens. More than ever, they seem to be ruling people out rather than in. If the labor market is tight, why is this the case? Ilana, let's get back to you on this. Allison's been frustrated with phone screening. A little advice there. And also, how does the person who's in their 50s, 60s and above and older kind of shape themselves so they're really ready to tackle the job market in the best way possible?
So most of my research was with people who were 45 and older, because those were the people who were looking for the jobs and the job seeking workshops that I was attending and beginning to do research in. And one of the pieces of advice that seemed to work best for the people I was talking to was not just to focus on networking, but to focus on the connecting to the people they had worked with in the past. What older workers have is a strong and long network of people who know what they're like as workers and who are in any number of different companies and can now vouch for them so that the
typical ways in which they're being blocked by applicant tracking systems, by recruiters who don't, like Allison mentioned, seem to know exactly what the job is or what they're asking for. They can get around these people, get around what they experience as the applicant, the kind of the black hole of application, by finding people who know them in these companies and who can vouch for them as really good workers.
What are some tips, tricks, and suggestions to get past that phone screening first? It must be a little almost discombobulating to be talking into a phone, and sometimes, of course, it's an online conversation, without being in the office and giving that person a good handshake. What do you advise there?
Well, part of the problem with the phone screen is that it's often not being done by the hiring manager. Right? It's often done by people who are not actually working in the office that is hiring. They're HR or they're a recruiter, and so they're trying to screen the likely candidates without necessarily having a hands-on experience with the job. And so part of the techniques that you can use, if it's possible, and it's really job-dependent, is ask questions that force the recruiter or the person in HR to engage with the hiring manager, right? To ask them questions that they cannot answer, and that they bring the hiring manager into the conversation in some way. That's one strategy I've heard that works.
Paul Harrington, over the past few decades, there's been, you know, a lot of focus on getting high schoolers into college. So we're kind of going to a completely different age group, you know, going for the 4-year degree. Of course, you know, it's good if you can get the degree, but there are, as you alluded to earlier, there are a lot of good paying jobs with benefits waiting in the trades. And former President Obama had tried to highlight this when he was in office. Do you see the trade industry starting to get a real second look from prospective seekers?
You know, right now, yes. You know, in the short term, construction and manufacturing industries are bouncing back. There's good growth there. But these are highly cyclical industries, so that, you know, when the economy turns down, that's where it will turn down, and you'll see the interest wane at that time as well. You know, for lots of kids coming out of high school, you know, part of the problem is they don't have work experience. You know, the work experience rates have fallen in half since 2000, so it makes you much less attractive to employers. And so as a consequence of this, the long-term employment earnings experience of these kids really is diminished. Even kids who go to college is diminished. So, and sadly, what's happened is we've become this sort of this one-trick pony where we've put everyone in the post-secondary system or tried to. You know, in Philadelphia, for 100 kids we put into a post-secondary, we graduate from high school, you know, 20 will eventually get a college degree of some, not a 4-year degree, just some kind of degree or certificate. So 80 out of 100 times, you know, we need to create a set of alternatives. We're just not structured at the secondary level to really do that. And that's a big miss there. It's just not CTE. It's all sorts of kinds of things to get kids ready, get them early work experience, get them tied in. Because the labor market's a social institution. And the way you get through this is you get brokered through. You know, all your listeners, if they think back when they got their first job and how they did it,
you
it wasn't a
somebody.
Resume. Exactly. Yeah. And that hasn't changed. You know, there's different technologies out there. And employers really, if you want to know what's on a resume, what should be on a resume, it's what employers desire. And they desire four things. They desire what I would call cognitive skills, reading, writing, and math in various proportions depending on the job. Second thing is they want some kind of occupational proficiency. Doesn't have to be a lot, but something that could show you could do whatever this work is. Third thing is they want these sort of social skills, negotiation, communication skills. And the fourth thing is they want behavioral traits. So somehow that's what a resume should signal.
What about training opportunities for young, for middle-aged, and older?
For older workers, I think one of the things that's really occurred in my lifetime is when I was a kid, older people just didn't go to school. And that has really changed. Post-secondary enrollments now, it's common to share of people 50 and above enrolled in school is much higher than it was in the past because the expectation of being in the job market for another 20 or 25 years is much higher. Even at the doctoral level, we're seeing this now. So a consequence of this is for older workers to think about rebranding themselves by going back and get a degree, a certificate in another field, a health field, an engineering field, a blue-collar machinist field, something like that. You know, it kind of gives you a different career pathway. Second thing that I think makes a lot of sense for people is, you know, firms, the problem is when you hire somebody, you're hiring a bundle of skills, but you're hiring this personality. And that personality sometimes might not be great. You know, I'm guessing a lot of your listeners have maybe worked with a toxic personality, right? I mean, it's not fun. And so firms are trying to figure out how to weed those individuals out. Well, one of the ways you do this is tryout employment. You know, at college, we call it internship or co-op or something like that. That's why firms like to participate in that. But if you're out of college, one of the best ways to do this is go to an employment firm, temporary help firm. And firms will often, that's that personal connection. That's that brokering function that I think can make all the difference in the world, particularly for an older worker, a middle-aged worker, to get access to a job.
All right. We've got an email from Lori in Allentown who asks, any advice on approaching a potential new employer with a skill set they're not yet utilizing but you feel would benefit them greatly? Alana?
I think that's a situation in which you really have to see if you can have a conversation with someone in the office in some way or another and find out exactly how these kinds of novel approaches get presented effectively. Because workers are constantly trying to suggest new ideas in an office anyway. And it depends on how that office functions to know which ways of presenting new ideas, regardless of whether it's a new skill set or a new way of doing something, that you have to figure out how best to do it in that particular workplace. I think one of the problems is that there's no standardized way to suggest this to an employer. Different workplaces function socially in very different ways.
So the key, again, is to finding a contact in the industry, in the office, and knowing somebody, as you said earlier, too, Paul. It's really key to develop those contacts.
Yeah, I think trying to convince
a firm. Yeah, Paul and I are both talking about brokering.
Yeah.
I think to convince a firm that they need your skills that they don't recognize, I think it's a tough sell. And, you know, the conversation is a two-way street, so Alana is exactly right. You got to know who's on the other end of that to make that sale.
Let's talk about the job interview, the very basics. You know, some advice for going in there and sitting down. If you actually get into the office and you're sitting before that HR person, Alana, what are some key things to remember? And obviously, one is silence your phone.
Right. You're silencing your phone, and this is a moment in which you're being judged, as Paul said, on your personality. And you're being judged on the ways in which you seem like, what you seem like you would be like as a coworker. And you want to be able to also anticipate the typical questions that they ask and offer as many concrete examples of what you have been like as a coworker in the past so that they can understand what you're going to be like.
If you feel a first interview hasn't gone well, is it okay to ask for a second try? Alana?
I guess it depends on the company.
What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. I think it's also tough to judge yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and but I think absolutely, sure, firms would be open to that. Yeah.
When is it appropriate to ask for feedback when you're finished with the interview, Alana?
I think it's always appropriate to ask for feedback, but it's often not what people have time to give. I mean, one of the things that I find really fascinating about studying hiring in general is that each individual job seeker is putting in far more time into the process than the people on the other side are. The people on the other side often have this as one task on a large plate of other tasks that they're doing, sure. And they're not paying that much attention to the hiring, which is really frustrating in all sorts of ways. They're just not given time to do the hiring. And part of what that means is they're often not given time to do the feedback, which they might feel is an awkward task. So you can ask for feedback, and sometimes people give wonderful feedback in response, but they often find ways to avoid having to do that.
And one other thing that causes many of us to fret if we're thinking about a job interview is, you know, you're standing in front of the closet. What should I wear? And I'm assuming, Alana, you're probably going to say, again, that conversation with the person inside the company or in the industry might provide the information.
Well, it's very clear to me that this is the case because at my at the Indiana School of Business, people offer one style of dress and strongly tell them that they have to dress in a particular way. And then the School of Informatics suggests a slightly different kind of attire. The School of Business recommends absolutely no color for either men or women, if at all possible. And then other companies are suggesting if you don't have any color, you're not going to fit in. So I think it really depends on the profession. There's problems offering too standardized advice at this particular level.
Yeah. Well, one, coming from a mother, become proficient with the iron is probably something that just kind of crosses the board for everybody. Let's talk about one economy that I had run across in doing research for this show. It's called the gig economy. People who put together a living by doing, say, several different jobs, one day, one thing, another the next day, and this might roll into what you were talking about with temp services, Paul. Define what this is, and is it a way of making a living in this day and age in which it seems that there are many people who are doing more than one job as opposed to the standard full-time job with benefits Monday through Friday, 40 hours?
Yeah, it turns out that's mostly not true. Hmm. The growth that we've had in the American economy has been almost exclusively wage and salary employment, what all your listeners are sort of used to doing. Gig employment, the way I measure it, is measured as something called self-employment. It'd be a 1099, for tax purposes, right? And it's really been some expansion in that, but not very much. Just the composition of it's changed a little bit because more of it's, Uber-like or Airbnb kind of like activity rather than setting up your own shop. But actually, overall self-employment rates, job business creation rates are actually lower than they used to be.
Really?
So it's really not an important source of kind of income for many households. That said, that doesn't take away from the idea that doing some kind of activity, being idle is for any job seeker is the worst thing they can do. Don't sit. If you go get Uber, go do something. Work at McDonald's, whatever you need to do. Being idle is catastrophic.
How do potential employers look at that? They see there's a big gap.
Because remember, if you're an employer, if you're a hiring manager, a hiring staffer, what you are is you're the risk mitigator. You're trying to reduce risk. So somebody's got a hole in the resume that looks like risk to you. You don't know why that's there, and you're never gonna. You can ask a lot about it, but you might not ever really know that answer. So you don't want to see a lot of idleness. You want to just see a lot of a resume should be designed to express proficiencies that you have, and it should be designed to say, I'm not a risky hire. And your interview should be designed to say, I'm not a risky hire. Mm. I'm going to fit in. Mm. Because in the end, the HR staff is on the hook for hires that blow up.
Yeah. Well, what about, Alana, if you have, say, that, the college degree or more, you can't find work in your chosen field, and you're, okay, I'm going to take a fast food job. I mean, how does that look to a potential employer?
You often have to explain that away.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's you have to find a way to talk about that job and what your other goals are, and maybe find some creative way to explain what you learned at that job. Because this too, sadly, as Paul says, is also going to read as risk, and I think it reads as risk inappropriately. People will wonder, why couldn't they get a different kind of job? What does it mean that they're settling in this way?
But at the same,
you need to find a way to explain it.
At the same time, better than having a big gap. All right. We're actually, unfortunately, out of time. Alana Gershon, I should say. So nice to have you with us for Radio Times. Appreciate the time.
It was such a pleasure to have a conversation with you and Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alana Gershon is author of Down and Out in the New Economy, How People Find or Don't Find Work Today. And Paul Harrington, a pleasure as well. So nice to have you in studio with us.
Thanks.
Paul is director for the Center of Labor Markets and Policy at Drexel University. And as always, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Check out our podcast, Radio Times, whyy.org/Radio Times. Adam Staniszewski is our engineer. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern.